This is Mary Flynn. I'm talking with Richard Carlon about the show of his selected work at Reynolds Gallery. Christine and Joan and I went this morning to have a coffee together down by the farmer's market, and I asked them what they had thought, and Joan was saying, well, she always loved your drawings best because there was more of your playful self in those, and she sometimes felt that she wasn't really communing with the intelligence that was in the paintings. And Chris said that when she and Howard were over at Bev sort of unpacking things, that was a very bright sunny day, and unwrapping those paintings with the sun coming in on, said it was like a revelation that they just sprang to life in remarkable ways.
That's wonderful.
And looking at the paintings, they're so lavish, while at the same time being very quiet.
They are quiet, yes.
Uh-huh. It's hard to say that something that gray feels extravagant or lavish, but they do. Same way that Mozart, who is extremely formal, is at the same time very Baroque and plays around.
But there is a reaching out, and I think that's part of it. Howard mentioned that to me. It's interesting you bring this up, because Howard mentioned that, and he also mentioned Mozart, which I thought was interesting. But he said there was a kind of reaching out, that the paintings reach out for those who want to participate in the experience.
Just thinking even of the ones that are the square imposed and then the square and the square, that you always think a window when you see something like that. Yeah. So that is an invitation to come through.
Yeah.
Sort of like going through the looking glass rather than just going through a window. But there did seem to me to be that wonderful sort of balance that I think is extremely classical between something that's very lavish and very minimal, that is in that sense Mozartian and very welcoming. But just thinking of how you've arranged the show, because I know the correspondences are something that you pay attention to.
A lot of attention. I pay attention to correspondences. Well, with this show, there were some unusual factors involved. Number one, I didn't know until 30 days before the show opened that the show was going to happen, which was fine, because Beverly was 100% behind it, and I welcomed it because it gave me a place to put my attention on things other than the distractions I've been dealing with the last 6 months. So the problem became with this particular show for me was, number one, I couldn't remember her gallery. I've been in the gallery many, many times, but I've never seen it empty on the second floor, that in the new section. I couldn't recall any of the architectural details except the two windows in the front, a place where a mantle had been at one time, and a small window in the back, and a stairway. So when we went to my studio to select possible works for the show, I didn't have any visual sense on where these things would go. I mean, in terms of, I thought there were just two rooms, there are three. The stairway is in the second room, not the first. I mean, it just, I had it all backwards. So we selected more work than would fit in the gallery, any space in the gallery. And the selection was made by me, Eleanor Rufty, Greg Carbo, and Jason Carlion, and Beverly Reynolds. When we were in my studio in the racks, I said, just pick something you think you'd like to see in the gallery. And so we got this work and got it over there, wrapped it all up and got it over there, and Eleanor and Greg cleaned it all up. And when we got there, it was on a Sunday, the work had been delivered to the gallery the previous Friday, and it was wrapped. And Howard, as you mentioned, Howard and his wife, Chris, and Beverly unwrapped everything and started just to place the things around in the space, because Howard was going to write an essay, and he needed to see what he was going to write about and how these things played off against one another. So when I walked in, I was, number one, stunned by seeing the architectural space. Secondly, where the stairway was, where the light was, really surprised me. I had no idea. This was in the middle of the afternoon was when I went, and so it was, and it was clear skies, they were just sun-filled or reflected light in all three of the gallery spaces. But when I saw the paintings next to one another, I thought, this is impossible. I'll only be able to show about five things because it looks so choked and jammed and cluttered. So I sat there a while, and then I got thinking about what I always do. It's like, okay, something has to be moved. It doesn't make any difference. Just move something to change the way everything looks right now. And so I asked Greg and Jason to move a painting, just pick one. And when they did, all of a sudden I could see some possibilities because it was impossible. And there's so many leaning against the stairway. Were they going to go or were they going to stay? So basically what I look at, I take into consideration the source of light because at the opening it's artificial light. It's fixed. It's always fixed. At this time of year, it's fixed after 4 in the afternoon pretty much because it darkens so early, so the gallery stays open until 5 or 5:30. But in the day hours, it's very luminous in those spaces. So you have very different experiences with the painting. That's a factor. Number two, if a room tends to be dark, and if a room tends to have limited light resources, that's the room I tend to put the largest paintings, and I did in the show. It's the middle room. And so whatever entrance to the room that you took, whether from the front or from the back or from the middle, because there's three, would be fine. And then the paintings, they weren't just the largest paintings, but they were very distinctive. One is so pale, if you blink, you almost miss it. You have to stand there a while and let the image, it's two rectangles and a rectangle, formulate in the brain pan, the visual part of the brain. The one immediately to the right of it is extremely hard-edged, and it's the only one in the entire show that has some sort of allusion to something other than what you're looking at. The others are abstract, all abstract. It looks abstract, but many persons at the opening and since then have told me, oh, I liked the landscape, or I liked the seascape, and it's the one that's a long, it's a wide, narrow one, and it has a black band that goes all the way left to right, and there's two verticals. It's very simple. What that is the two sliding doors slightly open against the balcony at the Belvedere Motel down at Virginia Beach. Ellen and I went down there. We just wanted to get out of town one weekend, so we went down there. We were on the balcony, and it started to rain, and the wind was blowing towards the balcony, so I just stepped inside, right, and I sat in a chair, but the two vertical to the edges of the glass, and then the black was the band where the sea turns dark when it's storming. So that, against this other very abstract painting that you could barely see, I thought set up a nice place. So in other words, what I'm getting at is that you can enjoy, if you choose, what is particular and unique to each painting, as opposed to looking for some sort of thematic pattern running through the pictures, because I don't work that way. I don't think that way, and I don't work that way. And then the other one appears to be a square canvas. It isn't. It's oriented horizontally, but it has a vertical element in it, and it really throws you off a little bit. It's very luminous. It's black and white, or appears to be black and white. This brings up another thing. In his essay on the show, Howard talked about its color. He mentioned something about its color. But there's only one painting that has an out-and-out hue in it, and that's the one with the green.
With the green.
And it's sort of a shocker, because everything else is very graphic, the drawings, black and white. And then the temper of all the paintings is very cool, sort of, or stark, depending upon their admixtures of black, white, and gray. But actually, they all have color in them. There's not a painting there that doesn't have red, orange, yellow. One of them has a lot of purple in it, dioxazine purple. And so what we're talking about is chromatic white, or chromatic gray, or chromatic black.
For all that they say gray, there's a tremendous warmth to them.
Yeah, I hope so.
And even though they say sort of white, or off-white, or ivory, there's a tremendous sort of warmth. And I, having watched the video, which too shows you putting on the red, which I guess is something of your method of working. That's part of their invitation, is that they are much warmer than they would appear to be if you were just thinking gray, black, and white.
Yes, yeah. So that, and the way they're hung, and that's a consideration, the way they're hung. It's subtle, but some are warmer than others. And so I try to place them in a way that it's subtle, but it is there, and it's there to be noticed. If one wants to pay attention to the paintings mm-hmm. that way, and if not, they're noticing it subconsciously mm-hmm. anyway. So another thing, of course, is the size and proportions of the work itself, and then the size and proportions of the elements that comprise the work. Mm-hmm. So you've got two things going on at the same time there, and then you have the room, mm-hmm. the real space, with the walls and the architectural details. And so all of those things I approach as I do making a painting itself. Mm-hmm. I translate many of the same concerns, vital concerns that I have in determining, okay, where does this edge begin and end? What is the size of this square donut going to be? How is the space going to act? How does this relate to the body as I paint it? Because to paint it, I have to get up, you know, within 18 inches of my arm, you know, to paint it. And then I look at it and I back up and it becomes something else. But the idea that all of these proportions are, as Howard brought out, do relate to the human body. Mm-hmm. And that's just something I'm sensitive to because I had professional dance training for a number of years and performed dance. And one of the great things about dance is when you're on the stage, you have to know where everyone is, though you're not looking at them.
They have, to me, the gesture of dance that I can see the Cunningham Company 1,000 years ago, and a piece that where everybody had their own movement, and they would come out at different times. And each of those paintings has its own flick of the wrist.
But, oh, great.
And they sort of go with the others who have another flick or a step from the
foot or whatever. That's beautifully stated. I love the analogy to Murs, too, mm-hmm. because that is central to his aesthetic. People doing many different things in a variety of ways at the same time.
Now, and using the same elements, the same way you do a rectangle, a square.
Yeah, very simple.
But they occur in time and place in different ways.
Right. But then there's another factor, and it has to do with gravity. This is where I do run into trouble sometimes. Depends upon if it's an artist-run gallery, I don't have a problem. They just say, go hang your show. Leave us alone. You know, they just go do it. But the Reynolds is a privately owned gallery, and Beverly's so wonderful. She's cultivated a huge following here. I think she deserves it. She's been very good to the artists. And she does have her own taste. She's earned it. She's worked very hard to develop this taste. And she has a notion of how things should be presented. And so everything is class A, and one of her favorite words is perfect. And I don't have any problem with that. Except when we get into gravity. And what I'm talking about is, where does a two-dimensional work hang on a wall in relationship not only to the height of the viewer, but to the floor. Mm-hmm. And my tendency is to drop it so that the top edge of the canvas, about 4 inches down from the top edge of the canvas or the drawing, is on the eye level of a 5'9" person, basically. And once one is placed, then that determines the placement of everything. Not that the measurement from the floor is the same, mm-hmm. but it gives a kind of level mm-hmm. for the entire exhibit. Mm-hmm. Beverly thought the work was hung too low, and she told me, and I'm glad she did. Mm-hmm. She said, well, I think the work is just hung too low, and I'd like you to come back and look at it. And I did. And there was one painting, there's no question it was too low. It was practically on the floor, and that was the green one. Mm-hmm. It was way too mm-hmm. low. But that had already been moved by Greg Carbo and Brad Burchett, the two guys that helped me. Mm-hmm. They hung the show. I couldn't hang mm-hmm. it at all, but when I was placing it, they were there. And they held it up, and I said, well, hang it there. Mm-hmm. And it was way too low. But this idea of my objection to paintings that are hung high, or any two-dimensional work that's hung high, is you start to look up to it. And the idea is the fact that there's a kind of buoyancy, or a kind of flying, or kind of loftiness, which I think lends a false coloration or feeling to the work, mm-hmm. that it's somehow above or beyond us, or it's
in
some
kind. It makes it much more of an other rather than something that you're on the same plane.
Yeah, you're removed from in a way. And I don't know, again, I'm not exactly sure where this came from, but it might be something that I remember Martha Graham said years and years ago. I heard her speak at the YMHA in New York. This was in the 50s. Someone in the audience, it was after this lecture demonstration she gave, and one of the women in the audience asked her about all the strenuous effort that was involved in her work, and she said, well, gravity pulls on us all the time. It never stops. And she says, we look at our bodies, we can see what it does to our bodies. And she said, so I'm trying to make an art that participates with gravity. And so I use my hip as a hinge to ride, and she demonstrated this, how she got up and off the floor using her hip as a hinge, or her idea of contraction and giving in and then pulling away from this powerful force of nature. And so in a way that stuck in my head, and I think maybe that has affected the way I think when I'm placing work on a wall, that where is the point where there's the greatest amount of tension between the experience of just looking at the picture, which can be passive or active, very passive or active, but in relationship to the room it's in relationship to if there's any furnishings around. And we're talking about trying to preserve the integrity of the scale of the work as well as the scale of the viewer. Mm-hmm. That's very important. Mm-hmm. To me, that's very important. And so, for example, when Ellen and I were in Florence this past summer, we had a wonderful time in Florence, Italy, and walked into the Uffizi and the Pitti palaces, I had a crick in the neck. I mean, I was looking up at everything.
Of course it was religious art.
And of course it was religious art, right. Or it's on pedestals going up towards heaven. You know, it's just like the spires, you know, the praying hands and the spires on the church. But it, I mean, I don't want to get overwrought about it, but it is something that I have been confronted with by various fellow artists and viewers that say, well, it seemed a little low, the show seemed a little low. Did you have trouble with it?
It did seem to me to be sort of on the level of, if you think in terms of a metaphorical door that you're going to go into something, it was on the level where you would walk in on that way. And most of the lines are sort of in that same sort of way too. And that isn't a big space. Those are three, and so they're fairly intimate.
Yes, they are.
For my mind, it increased the intimacy that they were closer rather than something you had to reach for.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you had that experience. And then the front room, which is the smallest, I put the most work in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 drawings, the video, and a painting. Mm-hmm. And there is 2 doorways and 2 windows in that room. So it's very broken up. But it seemed very cohesive to me when it seemed to hang well together. The vocabulary of the drawings is very different, very, very different. It's meant to be seen and recognized from the painting. But just the one painting is in there. And it's a split painting. It's a painting that's trying to push itself together, pull itself apart. I call it convoy. So I thought that with the drawings, which are so disparate, I mean, all the information is pulling itself apart deliberately through a different process, but it's through a chance-determined process. But I thought there was, a complement, some kind of complementary conversation or interplay was going on between the one painting and the 5 drawings.
One thing I noticed that they all shared, to a degree, were a certain number of horizontal lines, but the horizontal lines that refused to meet.
You know, that was an accident. I mean, that wasn't planned. That painting in the front room was one of the leftover paintings. We didn't know what to put in there. And Beverly said, well, what about this one? And I said, what? And she said, it's a 2-part painting. You keep forgetting it. You just look at the one part. The other part's in the other room. But it was in 2 different rooms. And when they brought it in, it just seemed bang. But then I did notice it had 3 horizontal bars. The drawing to the extreme right next to the TV has 3 bands across the bottom. It was interesting how that did tie that space together and the work together.
And the one thing that made me think of doorways is you stand there, you look through that very human doorway, then toward the big painting that's in the next room that has the black...
Black. I call them black donuts. Donut. It's like a black donut, yeah.
So that sort of almost patterns another similar walkway that you go in there. But I mean, it was sort of curious to look at, that the architecture and the work then sort of given that it is architecturally heavy, as opposed to a lot of gallery spaces that would be very plain.
It's not Bauhaus. Mm-hmm. No, there's nothing Bauhaus mm-hmm. or modernist about mm-hmm. it in that sense. It's a renovated 19th century house. Mm-hmm. And I like it because it was a house at one time. And I do like the fact the paintings may seem to be, the larger ones may seem to suggest they belong in public spaces, but I really mean for them to be lived with. And then as far as the back room goes, mm-hmm. that was the most difficult room to hang. It turned out to be the most difficult. Actually, we did it first, but it was the most difficult. Things went in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. The thing was that I wanted some connection. I didn't want it to be like three separate shows to suggest three very different thoughts, each one confined mm-hmm. to a space. I didn't want that mm-hmm. to happen. So I start looking at the painting that has 10 parts. Mm-hmm. Each unit is 26 inches.
Mm-hmm. That are going.
And they're going every which way. And I put them, it was my idea to put them by that stairway. Because if you're coming up the stair, it's very kinetic. Whether you're alone or with those people, you're very kinetic. And you come up the landing and it keeps on going down the wall and gets you into the room. Mm-hmm. That really worked out well. And that was a fluke because, I didn't remember where the stairways were until we got over there and I saw them. So that was a big help. That went up first. That got placed first. Then the green painting was all over the room. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed, well, it's green. It's other. We're going to put it in this alcove, that little recessional mm-hmm. alcove space. That worked well.
Is that chronologically the oldest piece of work?
It's one of the oldest. It would be 81, mm-hmm. I think.
And the Ophion?
Ophion, mm-hmm. yes. The title Ophion, yes. Yeah, from Robert Graves.
Ah.
It's a research Robert Graves did on Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. And I liked the name. And then he kept talking about snakes and green and jealousy. Mm-hmm. And he just went on. And it was just gorgeous. So that title, mm-hmm. the painting became Ophion because mm-hmm. I was thinking of Robert Graves. But that got placed, and then we had the other black and white one, and I liked the idea that as you walked, if you came from the front and walked to the middle room, you could see the other one has a black ground, one has a white ground, mm-hmm. the other's the reverse, mm-hmm. the proportion. But in your periphery, you could see that mm-hmm. in the other room. And then on the end wall, the largest wall, single, I put the smallest painting. And it was a very close valued gray painting. Mm-hmm. And then there was that one space left, and taking a clue from the front room where you had the three drawings that have hand signs mm-hmm. overlapping, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. group call. Mm-hmm. And then there's a play on that in the missaid group of three, which is in the back room, and they're almost in the same place on the wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like an echo in terms of placement. So I felt all those things and coalesced into a workable installation mm-hmm. that I felt good about.
The Brontes.
Yes.
I'm just curious the title for that one.
It's also from Robert Graves.
Robert Graves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I call that series of paintings slates, and there's 15 of them. Five have been sold over mm-hmm. the years, barely sold all of them, those mm-hmm. five. And these were some I still had in the studio. And actually I showed that at those in Beverly's gallery on Franklin Street. When she mm-hmm. first opened mm-hmm. her gallery, that was years ago, 1980, mm-hmm. 81, mm-hmm. 1980, would have been 1980. And in 81 she invited me to have a one-person show there, and I showed nine of the slates.
Mm-hmm. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. She opened with a group show in 1980. No, she opened with Bradford. Mm-hmm. She opened with a show of Jim Bradford's drawings and paintings, and he practically destroyed her brand new walls because he used 2x4s. He was nailing 2x4s into the wall. That's off the subject here, but that just came in. And Beverly at first didn't recognize him, but I have a video inventory of my work over the mm-hmm. years, mm-hmm. and I showed her that first so she could see what I had in the studio that might lend itself to putting together a show, and as she saw them one night after another, then the show came back mm-hmm. to her. So, and all of the titles, ties the work together is the generic title, which is Slates 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the subtitles, which are Brontes, Ophion, Thea, Thesis, so forth mm-hmm. and so forth. And
are they from the White Goddess?
From a book on mythology, on Greek mythology, mm-hmm. on Greek mythology mm-hmm. by Robert Graves. Mm-hmm. And it's a book I've read 3 or 4 times. I like the way he writes. I like his writing very much.
I like his writing, too.
And he's a real digger. I mean, he gets into stuff and takes you on this wonderful adventure. And I like the exoticism of the titles. I thought, well, nobody confused this with anything. Because the paintings are abstract. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not a... They function pictorially, but there's not a picture in them. But they're a pictorial language.
Oh, yeah. It's very gestural language.
Oh, yeah. And but there's not, if you're looking for a picture, you have to go to somebody else's paintings. I don't paint pictures. I paint painting.
But there is the sense of slate, which is one of those, something that you make a mark on.
Mm-hmm. Goes back to kindergarten, for those of us of a certain generation.
The old tabula rosa comes in there, too. But there's always that lovely layer of playful intelligence that is both deep, but doesn't beat you up in a way that has always made me enjoy your paintings.
Oh, I'm so
similar
pleased.
Way to the way I enjoy Mozart's music.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I'm extremely flattered. I'm just very, very pleased.
There is more of a classicism than a romanticism.
Oh, definitely. I work hard. My work was very early work was, oh God, clouds and darkness and
drama. Did you turn away from your internal Beethoven?
Turn away from it. Oh, I love Beethoven. I love
Beethoven. From your internal Byron. Maybe.
But I turned away from that. It just, I was uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm. It made me so self-conscious. I just thought. And then if you work with a classical, you're working with, that term to me has no limits. It just, it's just this broad field where so many things can occur. And so many great people have hung out. And you can learn from their example.
And
I mean,
so
enriching.
So many things about relationship and value of a form to another form.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than an immediate emotional connection. Right. That it's something that you as the viewer are always welcome, I think, to bring. But it's left for you to do that part of the work.
Yeah. That brings up a point. That what you just said brings up another point I'd like to mention, is this notion of intimacy. If you have large paintings in a small room, you're very aware of your body self in relationship to the space as well as the pictorial language of the picture, whether it's abstract or not. And if it's abstract, because it is intimate, instead of running away or just walking by it, and on some level, you're encouraged to dally a bit and notice how you're seeing what you're looking at. Whereas in a large gallery, you tend to walk along the wall and just see these spots. Mm-hmm. And not that you can't get something from a pattern. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I think you discover not just something about some of the things that paintings might be addressing, but something that's dormant within yourself as a viewer. It could be triggered when the things are close. They can begin to get close to you. Now, maybe I'm off on that, but that's my experience with lots of paintings. For example, Javier Tapia, I always look at his paintings close. Mm-hmm. He backs up, and we have a conversation, and he's against one wall. I'm 18 inches from the surface. We're having very different experiences, but I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's something about seeing the tremulousness of the paint mark he makes. Mm-hmm. It isn't smart aleck slapdash. No. This is a very nuanced kind of application of watercolor, and that says something to me about. And then they're all over the place. That the whole thing is built to these marks. That speaks to me, and I begin to find things in myself while I'm looking at it that discover things that maybe I'd forgotten. And it's nice. It's an enriching experience. Yeah.
Thinking of paintings, large paintings in a small room, I think of the room at the Phillips that has those Rothkos.
Oh, yes. Excellent.
And he uses the same sort of basic vocabulary that you do in terms of shape and form. And maybe more color. But there's the same kind of meditative quality that can take you in a room with things that are more or less monochromatic and large, too.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Wesley Gibson, the writer Wesley mm-hmm. Gibson, our friend said that to me one time. I forgot what show it was, mm-hmm. but he called me on the phone and said, and then he hung up. He wanted me to know it. I mean, I guess it flashed in and he noticed it, so he wanted me to know it, that he'd had that experience. Mm-hmm. So
think about the video. The wonderful thing about that, it's the things that are not quite happening again, too. With doors that are not quite opening, dance steps that are not quite completed.
Yeah.
And so that does set up a different tension in that room when you're looking at those little parallel lines that never, those little lines that never meet.
Never meet.
Basically, did you cut that sort of just by accident, essentially, of choice or certain rules that you set up, or is it, how did you determine where you were making all those?
Okay, what I did was to collect mm-hmm. things first, obviously. Mm-hmm. I had to collect stuff. And some of it comes from TV ads, some of it comes from TV shows. But TV shows that are broadcast at odd hours of the morning, I would deliberately get up at 3:30 and just wait. And then from, obviously, from videos.
And you have cable, I assume.
Yeah, I have cable. So I have many choices. Mm-hmm. But the conditioning factor was I wanted to find something that did involve action, that involved a human doing something. And there's only four instances where I messed up. You don't see anyone's face. It wasn't about Marilyn Monroe trying to open the door. It was the rhythm of the da-dun, 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 of the sound of the door being opened and closed rapidly through editing. Mm-hmm. And the sequence of things was completely determined by what I happened to hook together on several VHS tapes. I had to anticipate that someone was going to fall. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, most of the mm-hmm. imagery I was not familiar with. Mm-hmm. Some of the Hollywood films I remember there was a scene where Humphrey Bogart runs up a stairway, and there's all these rockets. I mean, all of these trumpets start to blare. Mm-hmm. And I did recall that and anticipated it. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite in the whole thing is Anugami in 8 1/2. This beautiful Egyptian-Italian actress seen from behind in a black cocktail dress walking up steps of wood. And you see her from the back. And she goes, dun, 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 dun. She turns to her left, and then you see her in profile, dun, 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 dun. And what I did, each time I copied that, I dropped one step. So instead of the 29 steps, it was 29, 28, 27, 26, until finally towards the end you get dun, 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 dun. She just got the one foot on the step. And then you let it go, and then I let the whole thing go, da, 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 and then you see my Maserati running up the stairs sideways and so forth. So they were just whatever the sequence happened to be as I came across the things on the master tape mm-hmm. that I used to extrapolate these things mm-hmm. from the television set.
It's very playful.
Oh, very. I loved it. It took me almost 3 years to make that.
Oh, it's a lot of little cuts.
Because it's a little tiny cuts, and if you would count them, some of them are just barely 2 seconds. Now that involves a lot of dial turning and mm-hmm. setting. And the only, it was the sound. Sometimes you hear sound and sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's loud, it's not often, and then sometimes it's barely audible. All that was done using a chance chart I made mm-hmm. out, and I had this student in CA operate the soundboard for me. And he sat there, and he would look at he could see by the numbers mm-hmm. whirling on the counter, when to pull the button down or push it forward. And I didn't want it just to be, I thought if it was just a steady state, the sound is all the same, there were no changes, that there had to be something that within the structure of the video itself that had something to do with the subjects in the video, that they're not completing things. Mm-hmm. You're not really sure. Or blink and again you'll miss it, or mm-hmm. like, will this please hurt? Can't we speed this up mm-hmm. a little? I mean, I wanted those kinds of feelings.
We want you to get there.
Yeah,
the satisfaction of arrival.
Arrival, the satisfaction of arrival, that's right.
You've worked in all these different media. Do you have pets? Or does whichever one you're working on at the time?
At the time, it's mm-hmm. the one where my attention is and my energy and enthusiasm. But I'm so glad, I'm just so grateful, I should say, that I've been able to work in so many different media, and I don't feel like the jack of all arts or anything about it. That used to be thrown in everyone's face in the 50s. Mm-hmm. If you were a painter, you were a painter. You didn't make sculpture, you didn't make prints, you were a painter. If you're a sculptor, you worked with lumpy stuff, as Tom was described. You bump into it, it falls down, hurts your feet, it falls on your foot. But I've never seen any real value in separating these things. So if I can take something, if I can think as a choreographer while I'm editing, I think that there's something that's to the good. I see that as a plus. Or that I can think in terms of color when I'm working in black and white. Or gesture or sound. You can bring sound in. You can have the voice. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot you can bring into your work. It would be, everybody has the same fantasy. You'd like to be able to see it all at once someday. That's never going to happen. Which is the fantasy of my brain, of some area of the visual part of my brain. But
somewhere there it's hanging out.
But it's all hanging out, and it's okay with me.
But not in relationship to architectural elements in a room.
Not if it's 2D.